Welcome to Product Tank Nairobi's first ever webinar. This is very excited. Today we'll be discussing how to improve communication between product and engineering. And this interactive webinar will be conducted by Matthews, short form Matt. Matt, welcome very much. We're really excited that you're driving this today. Before we start, I think I'll just give guys like a little bit of a format. Matt will be driving this conversation for about 40 minutes, after which we'll have a Q&A session. So during the talk, please feel free to use the chat feature to post your questions, after which we'll moderate the Q&A session immediately Matt completes his presentation. Okay, Matt, you can take it away.
All right, thank you for the warm introduction, and hey guys, officially. I hope you're excited because that's the first webinar. I am excited as well because I'm back in Nairobi, although virtually, but I have I say a lot actually, fond memories of the place, and I've met quite a lot of fantastic people over there, both from the product and the technology side. So that was really great. But at the same time, I kind of have a gut feeling that kind of you at least made some research about me so that you know where I've been actually doing my work and what kind of problematic I've been dealing with over the years. But I know that possibly you don't know one thing, that I actually started my career in software and in product, not doing anything remotely related to anything that you ever think would be connected with, let's say, development, because I actually made a master's degree in English studies. And English studies is quite a particular field because it's actually a combination of cultural studies, of linguistics, and literary theory. And of course, all of that circles around English, hence the name English studies. And actually, I wanted to start this webinar with talking about literary theory, because literary theory is in fact the art of literary criticism. So basically interpreting literary works. Now, there was a running joke at my university that you never could get two critics in the same room and they could never agree on a thing because they always had different worldviews on everything. And don't worry, like I have my case that will build right up from here, because let's take a renowned, easy to digest literary work. Let's say Complete Tales of Winnie the Pooh. Most of us are familiar with this because that's a childhood classic, a story about Christopher Robin and a teddy bear that has an affinity to honey and doing silly stuff. And they both, with let's say an amount of plush and real friends, go on off for adventures in the 100-acre wood. And yeah, it's a classic, right? And it's a cute story. So what else to it? Now, what if I told you that the interpretation of this work could be a lot more sinister? Because come to think of it, you know, Winnie the Pooh, Piglet, Tiger, all of those plush animals, they are land owners, right? They're home owners. And at the same time, they don't work anywhere, right? But remarkably and magically, they have infinite amount of honey, infinite amount of pop darts, infinite amount of balloons. How, right? But they also, you know, kind of live in that lavish lifestyle of an aristocrat, carelessly through the day, not thinking about anything else. But at the same time, we have the rabbit, which is a living animal that has his own plantation. But on that plantation, he has to have the final say. He's like the foreman of a bourgeois factory, basically ordering everyone what to do. And if you think about Pooh himself, he's like the embodiment of raw capitalism, because he does what he pleases without thinking of the consequence, even if he will get stuck somewhere. And actually, you could argue from a Marxist perspective that this book, The Oppressors and the oppressed, that deliver the honey and work for them. But they are not mentioned there, because as all of Marx's criticism will tell you, it's not important to read the text, it's important to rewind the lines. So there you have it. But okay, let's rewind that. And let's go for something different. Let's discuss Chris, for instance. Chris is a boy who's lost his mother. We know that. But taking that from the angle that would be propagated by Freud or Jung, we can look at him as a boy that actually developed an Oedipal complex that is kind of manifested and signified by the nursery stories we read in the book. And those, of course, are projected upon his set of plush toy animals, right? And quite ironically, plush toy animals that have no genitalia. And if you know Freud, Freud is quite picky about genitalia. So that's the case. And to be honest, what happens is that poor Christoph develops schizophrenia that puts him in a world where he can transform himself to the womb of the womb of his mother, where he can ask all of those childhood questions he would normally ask his mother, but instead asks his toys, his plush toys. That's psychoanalysis for you. But there was plenty of more where that came from. And you can, you know, interpret it from a postmodernist perspective, structuralist, neo-historist, post-colonialist, feminist, deconstructionalist, or post-structuralist. And it's actually, you know, there's plenty of more where that came from. And now we may think it's kind of unrelated to software development, but with that multitude of perspective, trust me, it's not isolated here, because quite so often people in software have a multitude of perspectives as well. And what is a result of that is this picture, which is older than the internet itself, about missed expectations, where everybody on the development team, on the product team, thought about something different. In the end, client will be dissatisfied, will be charged a lot. The quality will be poor. The expectations will be missed. The deadlines will be missed as well. Attrition will be high, and overall we'll be left with a high sense of depression looking at this. Now, why is that? So let's try to venture forth and try to come up with the causes for this problem in communication in developing products in general. So personally, I develop kind of three major causes why we basically miss expectations and have problems in communication. First is siloing. And by siloing, I mean basically putting people that do the same work in teams or departments or groups and dividing them by competence rather than dividing them by some, let's say, business value that they can add. Now, let me walk it through on an example. So imagine you have three teams of engineers. You have one team that basically has backend engineers, one team that has quality assurance engineers, and one team that has frontend engineers. Now, this looks more or less kind of familiar, doesn't it? Then imagine that all of those teams have their own development managers. Now, a development manager can be called in any sort of a way, like it can be a line manager, a project manager. Basically, it's a manager that's responsible for the people inside the team, as well as for the performance the team gives you. So basically, they have their own performance metrics, KPIs that they have to follow for the development manager to be kind of happy, because it's the boss of basically the engineers there. Now, on the other hand, we have the product managers, and those product managers use the engineers from those teams kind of like resources from pools, right? I have a product, I issue some work to them, they do work, and then they have to communicate, you know, throughout different departments to consolidate. Now, that does actually have some repercussions. But before I get into that, allow me to ask a fundamental question here. So where's the product, right? In many cases, if it's siloing, where's the product? And the product here is virtual, because it's only in the head of the product manager, because the teams themselves, they have their own goals, metrics, etc. And it's kind of often happens that in many companies that those teams work on different stuff from maybe because it's a component. They work for different products and they're not invested in one thing, right? Even if they work for a single product, they don't communicate with each other. So the backend engineers don't communicate with QA engineers in, let's say, I would say at the same time, right? They basically do it in succession. So basically you have a waterfallish process that's imposed here. Apart from that, what happens here is that if even product goals would be enforced, engineers inside will be split. And this is not only valid for engineers, right? I've seen that happen in design. I've seen that happen in marketing. So it's the worst position you could put your people in, basically being torn between your direct boss and your, let's say, product goals. So this kind of scheme also has one other problem. And that problem is that we don't play in communication. We play a game of Chinese whispers. And with Chinese whispers, you probably can imagine that all the meaning that we have is over time gets diluted, right? So basically, we don't get the full strength of communication. We don't communicate everything. Things get lost in translation and we just get a fraction of it, because to communicate over departments, over teams, we have to escalate. We don't talk to each other directly, right? Finally, even though many teams, even component teams like that, would tell you that they are following agile principles, in terms of product delivery, what we're doing is we kind of often do a hybrid where basically all of, because we treat our engineers kind of like workers on a production line, what happens is we issue them work. We don't work with them. So basically all the requirements, all the design, it's handed over to them saying, guys, do it. We already thought about it. And they then initialize kind of the scrum process. But at this point, it kind of like it's putting lipstick on a pig, quoting Martin Kagan, you know, it's still a pig. So let's recap what are the repercussions here. First, you have a very complex decision-making scheme. So we have the decision paralysis where you have, for instance, an engineer that is dependent on a range of managers or decision people, maybe architects, maybe UX people, but they don't have a single point of contact, for instance. So we cannot basically take decisions very early on. We have to, you know, have that all entire overhead, so people meet endlessly to try to come up with a solution. Then we have misalignment, because basically we are not really focused on delivering a single goal. Instead, we are kind of the engineers are put in between goals, so we don't have alignment across teams as well, so therefore it complicates stuff. Then we have weak team cohesion. Since we have QA people, let's say front-end people, different people from different teams working on a single product, but it's not the entire team they are in, just single people. We work with a bunch of individuals in a team, not really a team, right? So it's like kind of like Erlang processes, right? You have a process that basically individual and unaware about any other process. They just send messages between each other. Finally, we have diluted requirements. So basically, that's the game of Chinese whispers. Many things get lost in translation because we don't do direct communication. Now, if you're developing products and doing UX work, we often empathize, right? We often listen to our users, our clients, and etc. If we talk with our engineers, we often forget that we should have the shortest basic access to the users for them as well, so that they listen firsthand, so that they can communicate firsthand with each other on all of the let's say stages of the development cycle. And basically the most significant impact here would be this lack of empowerment, because what happens is when we hand over When we hand over work to our engineers, we treat them kind of like production line workers. We leave out all the responsibility, all the accountability, and added creativity to that of having ownership. And we just tell them, do this stuff that we already agreed upon. Even though to be an engineer, you have to be a really clever person. You know, it's not, you know, basically mopping the streets. It's kind of complicated to work, especially if you think about how sophisticated this can be. But okay, let's go back and look at another side of problem of that empowerment thing. And take a look at this Venn diagram. Basically, it's the design thinking ideal via, let's say, competencies of a product person, right? So first of all, a product person should be like the gateway of the engineering team to developing products. And the person should ideally kind of combine, you know, the questions of value, the questions of usability, and the questions of basically feasibility. So is this technically possible, or what kind of, you know, what kind of opportunities we can untap to basically call bullshit early on some ideas and to point to ideas that are, you know, low hanging fruits. And ideally that person should be right in the middle. So you should combine all of those three competencies. Sadly, and quite realistically, if we look at this, this is kind of wishful thinking, because it's very difficult to get a person that has enough business acumen, knows enough what user want and has the ability to do research, and knows enough about the technology hands-on to basically recruit one. And I kind of dare you, if you want to, as a challenge, to recruit a person like that in your technology stacks. But it's very difficult. And sometimes it's as difficult as finding a magical person such as this cat that knows Kung Fu on a unicorn that shoots laser out of its eyes with the rainbow in the background. Because it's as difficult as finding a full stack web engineer that is very competent. There's a reason why basically those competencies are kind of, you know, separated, because those areas are really wide. So to be a specialist in them, you kind of have to dive deep. So what realistically happens is that we have a product person that quite often combines the questions of value and questions of usability, but does not have the feasibility background. Now, if we work in this kind of worker-owner relation, and that product person basically issues work to the engineering that has the knowledge about feasibility, what happens is that we issue work that sometimes is completely not feasible for engineers to do. Right, but they are still forced to do it. And it might sound unbelievable, but I've seen big corporations and very big million-dollar projects that actually went that route, because someone higher up in the product chain took a technical decision and enforced that on engineering without involving engineering. And in this case, the, you know, the product person, it's not his or her fault, right? She's doing, or he's doing the best they can to basically keep the reins together, because they had the mandate to basically govern the product. And on the other side, the engineers, right, they can sniff kind of that the person has no idea what they're doing. So basically there's a lack of trust building up, because we're just issuing work. So what happens is that the only worker relation, we have hampered innovation, because the communication sometimes is just one way, because it's just, we're issuing work, we're not listening to what the engineers on our products, because we already agreed what features we want to kind of implement in our product, right? Then we have the lack of engineering trust, right? If you're going to be led by someone that gives you priorities, wants to create a product, you have to trust the person. You have to, you know, you have to trust that the person will lead us to a sensible future. But if the person is taking relatively poor decisions in, let's say, feasible aspects of the ideas, the engineers can see that it's not sensible. But at this point, it has been, you know, the machine has such a lot of momentum that basically our past the point of no return. So you have to implement a thing that is not sensible. And therefore, you have missed deadlines. And you miss those deadlines because first, your estimates have a lot of uncertainty. So you can be wildly off what you basically thought at the beginning because you haven't engaged engineering early on to discuss this with them. And at the same time, quality. Because if you're just issuing work to the engineers, you sometimes miss out the context of what they really need to create a proper product because it's full understanding, right? It's not, we are not the people in terms of product. We are not the people that basically will do this stuff. We're just trying to get that work to people that will. So it's very good to have them understand what's happening. And finally, it's a question of transparency, right? So basically being on the same page and understanding things and context the same way across the organization, right? If I say I want this and this feature, I would expect that everybody understands it the same way as I do it. All of my, let's say, UX knowledge with all of my data that I've basically gathered, all of my empathy for the users. From the other side, I would also expect to understand the technical terms, at least on the business side, that are delivered by the basically engineering team. So basically, it goes both ways, right? And quite funnily, when people adopt agile methodologies, right, they always remember the process. I bet you all know that if you're doing Scrum or Kanban, let's focus on Scrum. If you're doing Scrum, you kind of, you know, you are aware that you have the increment, you have 2 weeks, 3 weeks, right? You have the meetings, the ceremonies, you have dailies. All of people that implement that remember that. But nobody kind of remembers that the first pillar, the most important one, is transparency. So we all have to be on the same page before we start to inspect our work. Because if I say done, and my done is not the same as the done of the other person, it means that we cannot communicate well and our expectations won't be matched. So if we go forward with it, they might do their best, I may do my best, but basically we kind of get something lost in translations and we don't deliver what I want. They don't deliver what I wanted and they are depressed that they don't get what I actually issued them and they did their best as well. So quite funnily, at this moment, what happens is that literary theory comes to the rescue. I'm not joking. There's a concept called interpretative community, and it's actually a concept that was developed by Professor Stanley Fish and introduced in Interpreting the Variorum, and he's a professor of literature. So basically the thing is that Stanley Fish conducted a class on poetry in one of the American universities, and what he did is he wrote this on the board and told his students, this is a religious poem from a certain age that is similar to the poems they actually kind of interpreted in the past week. Now, the people in the class were from different backgrounds and from different, let's say, critical points of view. So they represented the whole spectrum. But he joined them by framing the story with a certain context and putting them in a room together. Now, he told them that and he actually left the room, right? And he told them he'll be back after lunch. Now, when he returned, quite remarkably, the students managed to get a very uniform analysis of this poem. First, because they managed to communicate within the room to each other. Second, and managed to brainstorm the ideas. Second, they all kind of managed to get meaning out of it, even though it wasn't there, because in fact, those are random names he found in the phone book 5 minutes prior to the lecture. And he just wrote them down on the blackboard and it seemed like a very modernist poem. And they actually managed to come up with an interpretation about Saint Jacob's ladder, because Jacob and Rosenbaum, that's wood basically. So basically it's a Jacob's ladder and you have to basically climb it. And the last name is, instead of Ochman, it's Oman. Like, whew, oh man, we climbed the ladder to heaven. We are good. And it worked. It's not the case, was it right, was it wrong? They all managed to have the same perspective. And how did they do it? First, they managed to organize, frame themselves, right? And they managed to align themselves. So let's try to use that to help our communication problem. Let's talk about reorganization. If we talk about reorganization, you remember this picture, right? We have our siloed teams that represent components or competencies. Now, let's try to take those teams and do something wild. Let's try to reduce the complexity. What if I told you we could have this? We could arrange people to represent actual products instead of competencies. Let's go even wilder than this, and let's throw in people that we wouldn't think about in the first place. So let's add a person that does UX to one product. Let's add a DBA analyst to the second one. Basically, even let's add ourselves to this whole thing. What happens here is that we compose now teams that basically have all the cross-functional skills required for us to create a product, right? We don't need any external sources. We don't need to escalate it far away. Of course, there are cases where for some cases we have to, but in most, we don't. We can work in team to create that. And we are joined by a common, let's say, common location and a common goal. But I'll talk about this in just a while. And as, let's say, a kind of particular thing, have a read on this today's tweet from John Cutler. As product thinking increases in an organization, we often see a shift. Designers and developers become more demanding of their product management counterparts. They ask for more evidence, data, and accountability for decisions. It's interesting to watch. And actually, this is what happens when we focus our developers, our engineers, our product, instead of what they are actually proficient in. And how do we align those people? How do we give them ownership? Now, of course, we go to alignment. Martin Kagan at some point said that we don't need mercenaries, right? When we're developing product, we need soldiers of fortune that we hire to develop code for 8 hours a day. We don't need that. We want missionaries. We want people that actually will be devoted to products. Now, of course, you ask me, Matt, it's insane. How would we make our developers be devoted if they're just doing the work for the money and they just go home? Now, to do that, you actually have to care about ownership. And the Patton, the three-star general from World War II, because he said, when he actually managed to be a general in the army, that you never tell people how to do stuff. You tell them what to do, and they will surprise you with their ingenuity. And that's actually what he did and why he was successful during World War II, right? So to align people here, what I'd suggest is using objectives and key results. Now, this is a very fairly known strategy for alignment, right? Setting up OKRs, in our cases, product OKRs, but it's mostly an exercise in doing this, basically delegating our authority as the person that has the mandate to change things and to do things in a product to our team, right? Well, I often tell people who ask me, how does product management work out for you? What do you do, basically? I always tell them it's kind of like curling. I don't know if you're familiar, but curling is this weird sport where you have the ice rink, you have people throwing a kettle on a target that's marked on the ice, and you have people brushing the ground in front of the kettle to make it basically slide to that target. Now, I always laugh that I'm not the kettle, that's the team. Not the people throwing that. That's maybe the business or executive people. I'm the guy with the brush. Basically, I'm trying to remove the impediments because I'm not an expert. I won't be doing development work, right? I won't be doing the UX work if I have UX people that do it and are more common. What I do is I tend to consolidate them and I try to make them cooperate with each other and strive for a common goal. So now let's going back to the OKRs. We have a product objective here, and that product objective can be attained when we fulfill a number of key results. Now, what's important is that those product objectives are driven internally, externally, so that basically people from inside the team and outside the team have a say on what kind of objectives are we going to make. So if we have technical debt problems and issues, it's also a say of the engineers, right? If we developing a new feature that is sensible in the eyes of, let's say, the stakeholders or maybe our research says that, the engineers also have a say in that. It's like a common, let's say, a common understanding that we want to drive here. And that is actually the first step because it's transparency, right? In product objectives, because many people will try to fulfill that. Many people will own that. The entire team will own an objective, and some of the people will own key results of certain type, right? So people will have a drive to do something. Then we have inspection, right? So basically at some interval in time, a quarter, maybe half a year, we'll revisit and see how well our key results doing, right? Are we on track? Are we behind? And depending on our inspection, we can basically go back, go forward, we can adapt, right? To give you an example of an OKR for a product team that could, you know, bind the team together, consider this. Let's increase the health of the system, right? So to increase the health of a system as an objective, we have three key results defined. And the first one will be to decrease the number of production bugs by 30%. Then we'll have the increase in uptime by 0.5%. And 90% of failures in production that are documented. I don't know if you noticed, but those key results aren't really focused on output that you have, on the number of features delivered, right? Those are mostly focused business results, right? And problems that we may have. So basically, OKRs are a foundation of a problem-based roadmap instead of a feature-based roadmap. Because nobody cares if we roll out a feature and basically nobody is going to use it, right? People care to basically have increased revenue, having business results that are meaningful instead of just... Another example of this may be this. Improve the mobile graphic user interface. And as a key result, we have identified 5 bottlenecks to increase the 21% advanced feature user base. The graphical user interface can be used by 75% of users without help. And decrease resource consumption by 60%. All of those are, again, business-driven metrics. And if we basically put those down to numbers, we just frame the amount of work that's necessary because it's like time boxing, box in the scope. So we have boxing in 5, let's say 5 bottlenecks. It's and of course, it's a negotiable thing. So the team has to agree upon that because all of those have to be smart. Now, again, it's team effort, right? It's problem-based. Now, what's important is that it's focused on the what, not on the how. So basically, we're not telling people what to do. People have the ownership, own that stuff, and have the creativity to implement things. I've seen many cases where people said, let's implement a new software for our, let's say, bookshop that will be based on microservices because everybody's using AWS or Azure or cloud services. Maybe that's not the technical solution that's best suited for that moment, but if you're not doing this, you shouldn't be actually taking that decision, right? Because maybe you don't know what would be the best solution, right? Then the best practice would be 3 to 5 key results per objective. And always remember that percentages are better than values, because values, numerical values, tend to stick, especially with people high up in the business or with executives. And they kind of haunt you, because it, once you say, for instance, I'll deliver, let's say, 5 of something, people will remember the 5. The same with dates, right? So you have to be kind of careful about this. Again, if you want to know more, I recommend this book by John Doerr. It's like an all-time classic, Measure What Matters. It's just like a good thing. But also to give you a real-world example of what actually objectives, results, and success metrics do, I wanted to give you a real-world use case and a history that is kind of sad, but it shows how the way we define our success governs conflicts, for instance. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with the Vietnam War. I'm pretty certain, though, that you are unfamiliar with Malayan Emergency, because for most instances, Malayan Emergency has been a wild success for the British, while the Vietnam War has been a large failure for the Americans. And I'll tell you why. Now, in the Vietnam War, what happened is the Americans measured success on the basis of body count. So basically, if I have a skirmish with an enemy and I killed more enemies than I lost my men, that means I have success and I'm successful and I'm winning the war, right? You could easily see how they could believe in that fallacious metric up till the end when Saigon has been taken. How come you only win just to lose the capital in the center of the country? It is insane, right? It means that your metric are kind of false or susceptible for falsehood, because, you know, you could, you know, make civilians' death count as enemy deaths, just pop them, for instance, arms, whatever, right? In the Malayan Emergency, what the British did, they had a similar situation, but they knew if they're dealing with insurgency, they, if they want to stop the insurgency, what they have to do is they have to stop the population to support them. And most of the population in Malaysia at that time lived in the jungle. They couldn't get to the jungle to protect them and to prohibit insurgents basically coming to the civilians. So what they did is they offered money to people to move to safe zones outside. And the success metric was how much of the population still lives in the jungle. And the second success metric was how many pockets of resistance are basically squat. When they moved all the people from the jungle, they just sent in commando units to basically deal with the insurgency. What happened is nobody now hears about Malayan Emergency, because we never hear about splendor, but we always hear about big, you know, mishaps like the Vietnam War, which was kind of pointless in many cases. So that's how metrics actually driven those conflicts. Now, for the end, I actually wanted to give you some best practices for great collaborations with the team. So those are a couple of guidelines that are kind of common knowledge sometimes that it's best to kind of use in your teams and your own organizations. So first is establishing transparency, right? So be sure that whatever you're doing with your team, everybody knows what certain phrases, contexts mean, what user stories mean, right? So basically what I mean here is that if you have a definition of basically the thing as product people we need the team to do, we understand it the same way as your engineers understand that, or your UX people, or the rest of the product. At the same time, if you have, so what the team needs from us, let's be sure that we all are on the same page. What does it mean, right? Let's negotiate the meeting. And finally, if you think about transparency, let's focus WH questions, not on how. Let's focus on why, what, who, right? Your team has all the capacity to figure out the how, and they will thank you for it, because if the team has ownership, they can devote themselves to work. Now, in my engineering experience, the worst thing that people have done to me is given me ownership. Because instead of sitting 8 hours in work and drinking coffee in the meantime, it made me come back to work at 2 o'clock in the morning, because I just thought about a bug that I couldn't get rid of. And I thought about a way to basically fix it after a year the bug has been in production and nobody could fix it. And I managed to do it. That's what ownership does to you, right? It makes you devoted. It makes you a missionary. And remember, ownership is not maintenance, right? So it's not have this, just maintain it, fix bugs, etc. Because it's not ownership. To be an owner, you have to co-create it, right? You have to shape stuff. Also, remember to write great user stories. So to recap, remember, focus on the WHs and don't say how. Now, user stories usually follow this schema, right? As a user, I want to do something so that something happens. Basically, those are three questions. Who, what, why? Consider this. As a user, I want to use my fingerprint so that I can log into the system. It looks fine at the first glance, but quite honestly, from an engineering perspective, it may lack some refinement because we just refer to the who as a user. Who's a user? What's his need, right? What's his pain? What's his gain? As an engineer, I would not know that. At the same time, the question of why is also lacking refinement. I don't know, apart from logging into the system, which is quite self-explanatory, I don't know why he wants this fingerprint thing. He could possibly log in just by typing his credentials, right? So we fundamentally here fail to provide our team with crucial and unique context they need to create basically the solutions we want them to create. So imagine how this would look like if I would rectify those lacks with adding something new. And we have this. As a mobile application user on the move, in a busy and crowded environment, I want to use my fingerprint so that I can log into the system fast without the need to use my other hand. This is telling a lot more. Basically, I'm using a mobile application and I'm on the move. I'm not sitting at a desk or on a couch. The environment is busy, crowded. Now, I want to use it because I want to log in fast and I have my other hand busy. That's why I need the fingerprint scanner. And this can fundamentally change the way how people think about designing it from technical perspective. So this can also not only be used for stories, right? We do user story mapping and etc., but we don't necessarily have to use this frame only for stories. We can use it for epics as well. So consider this, right? As a mobile application user, I want to use hands-free login methods so that I can log into the system without bytes. And this is an epic. But if we want to go to a story level, we don't necessarily have to come up with something wildly different. We can just work on this and create a subset of those requirements by doing something like that. As a mobile application user on the move in a busy and loud environment, I want to use my facial recognition so that I can log into the system without touching the device. And we can application user on the move in a calm and quiet environment. I want to use voice recognition so that I can log into the system without touching the device. So basically, we have two stories that are about hands-free logging methods. But one gives the context of a loud environment that is very busy, and the other one about the calm and quiet one. Basically, the technology behind them is different, and the context is, again, wildly different, but it's very much understandable. And all the requirements from the epic fall down, like the general requirements from the epic, fall down to those stories as well, right? Now, we can also divide stories to functional, and this story you already know, but as well to non-functional requirements. Because normally when we think about non-functional requirements is, let's say, something like dependencies, things that don't have usage scenarios, right? They don't function. But those are very difficult at some point to test, right? If you think about acceptance testing. So basically testing stuff that we are going to deliver to the world and ensuring it works. So what happens here is that if we try to frame a use case that can be tested the same way as functional requirements, but we can check, for instance, the libraries for the proper version, or we can check the OS for proper versions, or let's say the colors for proper colors, whatever we need, right? And this is especially visible with acceptance criteria. Now, talking about acceptance criteria, there's a behavior-driven development and Gherkin. Now, usually what people do is they just point out some points about, let's say, their findings. Like for that story we had on the fingerprint sensor, your basic acceptance criteria would possibly be that you want to run a certain maybe library, maybe you want to use finger sizes in, let's say, dark or bright rooms, but you enumerate that by, you know, like in a list. Instead of that, Gherkin, which is the notation for behavior-driven development, gives us a neat way that is also propagated by Martin Fowler to basically provide three conditions by doing a given, when, then paradigm, which is basically a division in precondition, trigger, and action condition, right? So with this, we can construct acceptance criteria that give us something like, let's say, three tests and three documentation as well. Because behavior-driven development is all about building the right product. And if the product is specified at the acceptance test level, so basically the business-facing test, we can ensure that all of our use cases from user stories are met. And the engineers understand that, and we understand that because we have a common language to basically frame that. Then we have a single source of truth to that, because we only rely on our requirements being in the single place, right? We can automate everything at acceptance level because Gherkin notation has a lot of frameworks that work with it, even Cucumber, etc., that basically allow to do automatic testing, not only manual testing, according to the notation. Now, those are as well living business requirements, because that list is your test list. And everything that is in that list is your current requirement in the system. So you don't have to maintain a bunch, let's say, of documents or Confluence documents, product requirement documents, whatever, that specify all the requirements. You have your requirements as tests. Then it's a team effort. Building those, it's not your responsibility alone, right? It's the responsibility of a team to come up with those. It's a team effort. We all are engaged from ground up. So we all should build those and refine those. And gives us common understanding. If you all come up with all of those scenarios, we have a common understanding of everything. And to give you an example of BDD test case, consider this. Given a user has launched the application and the user has not logged in to the application, when the user touches a registered finger on the fingerprint sensor and the fingerprint matches the registered finger, then log in to the application. This scenario solicits just this piece of the system and gives you this certain requirement with a range of conditions that have to be met. It's very concrete, very small, and it just should test this one thing. It's understandable for me, it's understandable for you as well, but it's understandable, and they can work with it. So basically, it's a great acceptance test case, and it's a great user scenario to work with. Now, if you consider user stories, this may look like that, basically. If you have a story like, as a mobile application user on the move, in a busy and crowded environment, I want to use my fingerprint so that I can log into the system without the need to use my other hand. Now, the acceptance criteria for that are given a user has and the user has not logged into the application. When the user touches the registered finger on the fingerprint sensor, then the fingerprint matches the registered finger. Then log in the user to the application. And basically have an acceptance criteria that's directly opposite, that should not allow you to log in and display an error. And that's the, let's say, user story that's really understandable to all parties. And it's what I'll call, let's say, an A-grade user story, because it fulfills all of my criteria for a good user story, right? And if you want to read more on about acceptance criteria that are written in that format, if you go to the meeting, to the meetups, basically invitation, and decide that you have a reading list that you could read up on. And as for now, that's everything from my side. I know that basically I'm touching upon many topics, and I'm not going in depth because I wanted to give you a wider overview. But if you want to go deep sometime into some of those areas, just give me a shout. So yeah, so thank you. And now let's go to questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Matt. There's one question here from Lois, and he's asking, how should PMs run effective meetings so that engineers don't view them as a waste of time?
Now, always meetings for everybody are considered a waste of time. I know products that basically organization that have managers just meeting people for meetings and doing meetings all the day because they have that much complexity. Basically, my best case would be to limit the amount of meetings to those that don't introduce waste. Basically, meetings should, like, I remember at some point in one of the companies I worked for, we had a very good poster saying, are you getting your meetings worth, right? 1 hour of everyone's time, people in a team, makes 1 day of missing work. So if you're wasting, are you really certain to waste one staff day of work to have this meeting? Maybe that's a good case. Also, I would really recommend people to, if they're going to have a meeting, they should have a meeting that involves the people that are in that meeting. So basically, if you can be, you know, have some ownership, have some input to it. If people are just going to sit there and listen, that's not getting your meetings worth. You could basically send that out with an email.
Okay, cool. Moving on to the second question from Rama. What can product designers do to help communicate effectively with engineers?
Basically, what I would say is to be embedded in the product team. Because designers have the same problem as engineers and as product in general, right? If we're not working side by side together in, let's say, one delivery stream and one common goal, right? We're having to communicate across organizations or across teams. And that always is a bit of a Chinese whisper, and it's always a bit of, you know, trying to cut in on someone else's time. Because when people try to estimate for effort, they don't take into account, let's say, side of the team that much, because those things are kind of unpredictable in many cases. There are methodologies that try to counter that, but are not really efficient at that. And I'm looking here at you, Safe, but yeah, they're not really efficient at that. So my best guess would be trying to have as much face time as needed with them, co-locate. And if you can, try to be in the same team as your engineers.
Cool. Okay. Tessie has one here about what is the best and most effective way for product managers to do documentation without handing engineers documents that take too long to read.
So basically, my best answer would be to follow BDD, basically. So if your documentation is behavior driven and your documentation basically is your test acceptance acceptance regression, that means that you have a single source of it. It's fairly easy to understand from a perspective of a product, but it's also really useful and understandable from the perspective of your engineers. Of course, that does not mean that you don't have to have, you know, the user story to it or the epic, because sometimes, you know, the epic gives you a wider context, a background, everything, like some research that engineers would also love to have. But if you're thinking about the engineering level documentation, what you should have basically. Because if we're doing product work, we shouldn't be dabbling in, you know, anything lower than our business cases, because it's not our competency. Like, I would never remember how to basically fix my piping, or my mechanic how to, you know, replace my camshaft. The same thing, I wouldn't meddle with engineering documentation and telling them what to do.
Okay. James has two questions. The first one is, how can you choose the right people in the engineering team to have meetings with that will be responsible to communicate with the rest of the team?
Okay, my answer would be, don't involve just special people, involve the team. Like, if you want to be transparent with an organization, because look at this from this perspective. If you're having a meeting, right, with just, let's say, a team lead, and if you're agreeing something with the team lead, you basically are playing a game of Chinese whispers. Of course, there are some cases of high importance and then cases of low importance, right? If we're discussing something that's relatively not crucial for everyone to be on the meeting, because they can delegate someone that's really competent to answer in their favor, then sure, you can pick someone that would take up this, but it should be a kind of a team decision that they are doing this. It shouldn't be a cherry picked person, right? That I'm talking to you, developer A or developer B or team lead, right? It should be kind of who to send. But if it's a crucial decision, ideally all the people should be invested. But again, as I said, all the people should also have a say there.
Okay, cool. The second question from James is about, how would you manage the teams with a common goal, and how would you guarantee consistency across the board? It's a compound question. And the second part is, how can an organization design the merged team system? What is the criteria of selecting the individuals in these merged teams?
Basically, okay, let's start with how to manage teams with common goals, right? So if we have a team that has a common goal, right? Let's say a product. Basically, a product team should be governed by some alignment rules, which are OKRs. Now, you can have OKRs that span across, let's say, a range of smaller teams. If you think about teams of 8 people, right, or 6 people, you can have, let's say, 2 teams that are 6 people, you have 12 people in total, right? And you can have OKRs that touch upon both of them. But you have to remember that the more you scale that up, the more ownership gets kind of diluted in some way, because at some point, you know, some people will be just responsible for a part of the OKRs, some people will be responsible for some other key metrics, and the communication between those teams will be kind of vague and different. There are some techniques to kind of counter that, where you have people that kind of, you know, that your teams are placeholders for people, and basically you manage to take people and swap them around teams, right? And I actually had one case in my career when I actually had 2 teams of engineers. Basically had, you know, depending on what we wanted to do, we picked the right people with the right competencies for, let's say, the right job for a certain team, and we just popped them into that team, and the other team was composed of some other people with other competencies, and those people basically mixed and migrated, so they weren't actually fixed in those teams. Those teams were basically just there to ease management. teams that of more than eight people basically are very difficult to handle in terms of, you know, collaboration, because, you know, it's very difficult to communicate across the board like that.
Okay. And what would you say is the criteria for selecting individuals in those teams?
I would say the current needs of what you're going to do. But the key here is not, again, to cherry pick people. Yeah. Allow the team to self-organize, right? So allow the team to see, guys, we're doing this. Can you see the importance? And everybody, you know, yeah, we can see the importance to do the next, let's say, 2 weeks, 3 weeks from now. So how do we approach it the best? How do we divide? I don't know. But like when I was in school, what we did is basically when we played football in school, we had plenty of people on the bench and we had two captains and they just, you know, picked people onto their teams basically. So this is what I did with my teams. Basically, I swapped the captains each time and they cherry picked like people with whom they'll be working. But the ownership was rotational, right? With this, but it kind of enforced this notion that everybody is responsible, accountable for everything, and it's not a position that you are in forever, and that's why everyone got the taste of it.
Got it. I have one last question here. This is from Solomon Timon. He's asking, which product development approach can BDD best be implemented?
So what do you mean by product development approach?
Yeah, that's what I was asking here, but I think he means one of the approaches, either in the agile method, any of the delivery approaches, agile or waterfall.
Okay, fair enough. So basically BDD is not really a thing that's connected with how you... The notation itself is not really connected with the approach, right? You can do it if you want to do waterfall, if you do want to do agile, but the BDD mentality basically is to collaborate across the board on the criteria, right? So this kind of means that it's very difficult to have this happen in a waterfallish situations where, you know, business requirements are handed over to the design, then they're reviewed, handed over to, let's say, someone else, compliance, blah, 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 and then they're handed over to engineering. Because at that point, you know, all those BDD scenarios are kind of predefined and people just made those decisions higher up and you just have to live with it, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're involved in that from early on in terms of engineering, you can have a say like, guys, don't do it because this, from a technical standpoint, will have us to rewrite half of the code base to make that happen. But we suggest we do it the other way around or in some other way. Because most of the product, let's say, problems that I've seen is that basically people don't involve the engineers in that decision-making process. And, you know, those are smart people. And if we're not involving them, we're not really getting our money worth for, you know, paying them a lot of money to develop code and give their knowledge to us. Okay. I would urge to use, you know, agile methodologies, any kind of methodology that kind of urges you to work alongside your developers.
Okay. One other question from Samuel Mbogwa. He's asking, how would you go about it when stakeholders who call for meetings have like preferred people to call for a meeting rather than to pose it to the team for self-organization?
So basically, I would never allow stakeholders to cherry pick people from my teams to, you know, talk to them, or because that, you know, kind of introduces obfuscation and it's not really transparent. So basically what I would do is like, when I told you the curling story, mm-hmm. I would shield my teams, right? If I, for instance, let's have an example, right? If I have a CEO of a company that wants to, you know, talk with certain members of the team to issue them some work, something, whatever, because he likes to talk with them, I will step in and I will try to shield them. If I cannot shield them because the business pressure will be too high, try to arrange something that basically is not cherry picking one guy, because it introduces obfuscations to the rest of the team. But I will do a rotational basis that everybody has a say in it. I know it's difficult, right? But I think being in our position as product people and people responsible, it's our duty to stand up to what people basically give us. Our employers give us, our bosses give us, and they pay us a lot of money to do products. So we should basically listen. I know you're doing this in good faith, but it's not sensible because of this and that, right? So it's a matter of shielding your team, never passing forward what happens, right?
Yeah.
The rule of thumb is, yeah, basically whatever can happen to me, right? But the team has to be, you know, left in peace. Also, you know, if you get people to get kind of like this, it introduces kind of confusion because it's context switching, right? And it's a lot of estimates to go down the drain, basically. So you can always argument that one meeting, basically, you're not losing 1 hour. You're losing actually effectively a day of work if it's midday, for instance, because that person has the context switch and get back into the groove to code. So it's the person's call if he wants to invest, let's say, a staff day of work to pull someone out. You have to be creative sometimes to be argumentative here.
Yeah, cool. Okay, I don't think there's any other questions. So I think I might as well just wrap this up right now. Matt, thank you very much for that insightful talk. I think there's quite a lot to be learned from the insights you just shared with us today. For the rest of the guys who attended the webinar, thank you so much. It's our first ever webinar. So what we'll be doing tomorrow is that we'll be sending over a survey that would like to get a bit of feedback as to how we can improve this kind of forums. And also the webinar has been recorded, so we'll be sharing the slides and the recording with the wider community and also for you guys, just for your reference. So Matt, any last words?
Yeah, guys, I just wanted to thank you for inviting me. It's great to be back in Nairobi, although virtually. But yeah, I could have all the memories coming back to me when I was been doing product work there. So thank you for having me, and guys, have a good day. And yeah, cheers.
All right. Thanks, guys. Have a good evening.